Hello, I'm Gabe Filippelli, and this is season 5 of The Collective Tap, podcasting from the College of Communications at lovely Butler University campus. This season, we're diving into 5 important issues facing water in our communities in Indiana. In this particular episode, we're talking about wetlands. We're talking about regulations of wetlands and the future of these critical assets, these wetlands in Indiana. I'm joined by Rochelle Baker, who's the owner of Little River Consultants and co-founder of the Indiana Wetlands Association, and Scott Matthews, a regulatory specialist at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Welcome to The Collective Tap. This is Gabe Filippelli, your host. On the show, we talk about various things related to water. We're all water, H2O all day long. We had a nice introduction already to some of these issues of water in Indiana. We're going to touch into these. Today, we're going to talk about sponges. Not the sponges you use to clean your sink or the sponges that I almost stepped on in the Caribbean last week, but we're talking about a different kind of sponge, and this has been considered nature's sponge. So these are wetlands. You can think of them as swamps, fens, bogs, marshes, bayous. They have different characteristics. And if you were to take a time machine and go back, let's give it 200 years, to the early 1800s, and you were to this time machine happened to fly, which would be a kind of cool time machine, and you were to go over the northern part of the state, you'd find a state that was awash with reflective water surfaces. These were the great swamp or the great wetland of northern Indiana. And you clearly don't see that now. You see farm fields and residential facilities. So we can already reflect on the fact that things have changed. Things have changed and been shaped by humans. So we're going to explore on this episode how wetlands play into the environment, what's their current role, who protects wetlands. Last time I checked, they don't vote. They don't, raise taxes. So they need a different kind of protection than a citizen, for example. I am joined by 2 phenomenal guests today, Scott Matthews from the Army Corps. Scott, tell me a little bit about what you do at the Corps. Well, actually, tell me first, what in the heck is the Army Corps? Do you wear a uniform? You're not in uniform right now.
Good afternoon. No, I'm not in uniform. It is the Army Corps of Engineers is part of the military, part of the Army. It's a branch underneath there. We are mostly civilian. We have military management and there's military personnel, but we're primarily civilian. And there are engineers, several different divisions within the Corps all throughout the country. Most people are noticeably going to know us for dams, flood control, navigation. But we also regulate wetlands. We're tasked and assigned by the EPA to regulate the 404 Clean Water Act under wetlands.
And that's a little known fact. I mean, when people think of the Army Corps, they think of the Mississippi, keeping it navigable, right, for example, and keeping it flowing. So that's interesting.
Correct. That's the reason why, one of the reasons we were kind of tasked with 404 is we were already managing the navigation in Section 10 of the Navigable Waters Act, so dealing with those type of things. And so it has been kind of delegated to us by the EPA. EPA still has the administrator of the program, but it's delegated down to the Corps to implement it.
Okay, great. And things like the 404-20, we'll get to that in a little bit. We'll get some definitions. Rochelle Baker, you own and manage Little River, a consulting firm. Tell me a little bit about Little River and what's your mission?
We're a consulting firm, and we help people kind of find that balance between development and conservation or mitigation. If someone has a project, they're going to be doing earth moving. They have a potential wetland on their property or multiple. We go out and we delineate the boundaries of that wetland. We help them apply for the proper permits, and we help them get their mitigation in order if it's needed.
Okay.
A lot of our work is with the Department of Transportation. You know, obviously bridges have to be replaced, roads have to be maintained. So there's always, with bridges, there's, you run into streams and wetlands. And so that's a big driver of our work.
So sticking with you for a second, Rochelle, what in the world do wetlands do? How do they benefit us?
So many ways. So you used an analogy that you hear a lot. They're the sponges of our landscape. Some people describe them as kidneys. Because they do a lot of cleaning of our surface water. I've taken to referring to them as the multi-tool because those two things are pretty well known. They help control flooding in that they hold excessive runoff during heavy storm events, rain events. They hold that water up on the landscape instead of allowing it to quickly be rushed to the nearest stream, and then it all collects too fast and floods. You know, we're seeing a lot more big events these days. So wetlands are going to, you know, they're going to help attenuate that flooding. And then on the flip side, even isolated wetlands are going to hold that water and let it kind of percolate down to groundwater and kind of prop up our groundwater, because, you know, we're getting a lot more bigger events, but we're also getting longer stretches of dry, hot weather. You've probably noticed a lot more pivot irrigation going in. That's pulling from the groundwater, deeper groundwater. So wetlands are kind of the natural way of propping up those groundwater levels. Scott, you said something about that the Corps regulates navigation on the Ohio River. The Ohio River has been getting pretty low lately. In the last 2 years, in October, I think it's been, correct me if I'm wrong, impassable by larger ships. And so wetlands can, you know, they can do both things. They can prevent flooding by holding the water up on the landscape, and then they can recharge the groundwater so that when we have those longer dry stretches, they can provide water to perennial and intermittent streams, which are at risk of drying up, like the Ohio, the big Ohio. And then also they can keep those groundwater levels higher for crop production. All of those great hydrologic benefits. There's wildlife benefits. Most of our endangered plants and animals in the state have part of their life cycle that's dependent on wetlands. There's the water quality benefit. Wetlands filter out sediment. They filter out nutrients, other pollutants. But they also, as part of that, keeping the streams from flooding, streams are, you know, ripping themselves apart. And that adds to the pollution in streams. And so wetlands, their ability to attenuate flooding also attenuates the scour that's happening in the channels. I mean, that's just kind of touching on the surface. There's also carbon sequestration, probably lots of things we haven't even, you know, thought through.
No, that's great. That truly are the Swiss Army knife of the environment. I love that. Scott, can you, are all wetlands the same? Okay, so you've heard of, maybe you can define what a constructed wetland is versus a natural wetland for the audience, but do they act the same?
So a constructed wetland is usually man-made, so it's man-influenced heavily usually, so it's designed and constructed for the most part. A natural wetland is one naturally occurring or has developed over time based on conditions that man has altered the landscape in some form. They do not generally act the same for a good period of time. The goal is, with constructed wetlands, the goal is to get those wetlands to be highly functioning. But a wetland takes a long time to form. So it has to have hydric soils, it has to have hydrology, it has to have hydrophytic vegetation. Essentially, soils formed under lots of water, consistent inundation, and plants and dominance of plants that like water. And so a natural system to develop those things, to develop the soils, may take tens of 20s, decades. I mean, some of them can take a long time. They can form faster under right conditions, but they can take a good while to form. And so when you see the naturally occurring wetlands, they're already past that initial development phase. They are much more highly functioning. So they are able to, using the sponge analogy, to be able to absorb those nutrients, the ability to filter those pollutants out, to be able to withstand the flooding and absorb more water going in. A constructed wetland can do that, but it takes time to get there. And to construct a wetland, you have to disturb the site most of the time. The site's disturbed. And so you have to get past that initial disturbance, let the site settle, and then kind of let that site develop as it's going to. With generally in constructed wetlands, we have goals that we want to attain or get to. So you're trying to meet those goals, and it's usually a battle because not everything that you may think you want to be done, Mother Nature may have different ideas. You can have the best laid plans, but Mother Nature still may have another idea based on weather patterns, soils, something you has just been unforeseen.
She certainly has a lot of opinions, hasn't she?
Yes.
I mean, she's usually right in the long run.
She usually has the final say.
She usually has the final say. I'll stick with you for a second. How have they been regulated? Like, and are they regulated?
So wetlands are regulated under the Clean Water Act, Section 404, that was designed in the 70s when this Clean Water Act came about in the 1970s. So they've been regulated since then. Section 404 regulates any discharge of fill, so it's the placement of fill into a wetland. And those are for wetlands that are federally jurisdictional. So that means those are connected to a stream, to a river, to the navigation. The Clean Water Act deals with all federally regulated jurisdictional wetlands. Okay. That comes into play because that's where you see a lot of the discussions and the regulations now about what's regulated, but that's a whole different topic. But that essentially is how we regulate them. So we regulate those discharges of fill. And so when an applicant, when a landowner, a builder, developer wants to fill a wetland and manipulate a wetland, they need permits from the Corps of Engineers under Section 404 and usually a state regulatory agency like IDEM under the 401 water quality certification. The state will issue a 401 water quality certification that is a part of, that is IDEM's approval for the Corps' 404 permit.
Gotcha. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Yeah, no, that's interesting, and I think we'll touch on this a little bit later. The Supreme Court decision that changed the way I think we think about, well, changed the way the law thinks about wetlands. But I'm going to touch on that a little bit later. Rochelle, I'm going to turn to you. One our last episode, we looked at the White River scorecard, report card, and you know, as a teacher, I was appalled to see how badly we had to give, what a bad grade we had to give to the White River Basin in general. Some component of that is wetland loss. I'm not talking about like from the 1820s. I'm talking about current extant wetland loss. Can you talk about that a little bit? And why are we still losing wetlands when you've told us that we should all have our Swiss Army knife of resources?
Part of it has been kind of the football that the regulation has become. Every new federal administration wants to interpret what waters of the state means. And so protection has kind of ebbed and flowed. And a lot of it has been hung up in the courts, trying to decide, is this constitutional or not? And so where we've landed right now is that very little is protected by the federal government at this point. At the exact same time, there have been attacks on protection at the state level for what are called isolated wetlands, meaning there's no direct surface connection to waters of the U.S., which is a significant portion of Indiana's wetlands. We've lost protection at the federal level. At the same time, we've lost protection at the state level. And then there has been a lag in getting mitigation for permitted impacts in the ground. I'm sure that the report card, how far back did it go?
It went back several. I mean, it's been reissued.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we get it. Yeah. The student is not improving.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Only a little bit.
So, I mean, you always have people who think it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission or hope they won't get caught. And so those impacts are never mitigated. And so that's just a wholesale loss. You have people that don't recognize that they have wetlands on their landscape because they have an image in their mind of what it should look like. And, you know, their particular wetland doesn't look like what they expect. So that's going to be an unknowing violation. And that's a wholesale loss. So they aren't getting the protection they deserve because they're not recognized on the landscape. But worse than that, their value to humans is not recognized. They're seen as an obstacle rather than an asset on the landscape. They're in the way of housing. They're in the way of farming. No one is seeing or no one's connecting the dots between wetland loss and what we're seeing in our streams and rivers and our water quality, our water quantity. Unfortunately, with the Clean Water Act and with a lot of the people that are in our state legislature, it's commerce. You know, it comes down to money. And until you can connect the dots between, hey, we're losing wetlands, and as a result, we're flooding communities, we're tearing up infrastructure, and that all has a cost associated with it. Until you can draw a straight line for people like that, between wetland loss and cost to the taxpayers, they're not going to value wetlands. And until wetlands are valued, they're not going to be protected.
And that really harkens to what, you know, the great Eleanor Ostrom, the Nobel Prize winning economist from IU Bloomington, who was the first person to really introduce in economics this idea of the value of environmental resources. They have a fiscal and a health value. They really do. You can put them as a dollar ledger, but again, they don't vote and they don't pay taxes. So it's tough when you have a federal landscape that's not being more supportive, and then you have a state landscape that's openly hostile to some natural spaces, or at least valuing them. So I'm going to have a quick pause because I need to know from you guys, because I already have my favorite. What's your favorite wetland, Scott?
I'm going to do a forested wetland.
Oh, yeah? Forested. I was talking about this specific one, maybe.
Oh.
So people can go visit them.
My better favorite wetlands are the ones out in private that I see. So, I mean, there's a lot of private ones I've seen that are out in out in the middle of nowhere that are just beautiful.
Beautiful. So, okay.
So they're not really private or public to go see, unfortunately.
All right. Well, that's good. Rochelle, you had a good 25 seconds to think.
Miskatonic National Refuge because of proximity. And it's awesome. They have a really cool kind of nature center area. And then they have a driving tour and a lot of birds stop over there. It's probably the closest large wetland to my house.
My vote is for the Great Marsh in Indiana Dunes National Park now, I guess. But, you know, all for very different reasons.
I'm with Scott. I lean towards forested. But,
oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So that's where I think Miskatonic has both, but I like the forested.
Miskatonic is beautiful.
All right. Well, you guys have planted your stake in the ground. We've heard about how wetlands need protection, and we've heard about the value of wetlands. Who doesn't like wetlands? Like, what are the organizations or the groups who are against wetland protection in the state of Indiana?
From the core standpoint, everybody has... There's no one that we know that is against them. Everybody has an interest in doing what they want to do. So we've reviewed projects. So it's not that anybody's against them. They have projects or ideas that they want to do that may include manipulating the wetlands. So I haven't really found anybody that's for sure adversary against them. They have their conflicting interests, per se.
Very good political answer, but a good one, a realistic one. And I think, Rochelle, without naming specific characters, you basically in broad landscapes described those. It's maybe farmers, home builders, not home builders individuals, maybe home building associations.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear if you look at the current version of the state rule wetland regulation, there's an exemption that specifically calls out home builders. Mm-hmm. So if you're developing land for building homes, they have their own special exemption. And they don't hide the fact that they had a heavy hand in writing the rule and the now law. They are throwing around numbers that indicate that regulation is pumping up the price of home ownership. It's a myth that has really caught on. Mm. And so people are associating this, what they are characterizing as overregulation, as being burdensome and making it impossible for young people to afford homes now. Obviously, that's not the case. When they say that 25% increases because of regulation, they're talking about safety code. They're talking about, you know, building code. They're talking about OSHA requirements. Mm. They're talking about local permits they have to get. They're lumping it all together, but they're presenting it as it's wetlands. So that has been a real popular drum that's been beat, but is not completely accurate.
It's like the old argument that the car companies used to say when leaded gas was when there's a public health crisis around leaded gas, because it's terrible, it's an awful idea. And the car company said, well, we can't get off of leaded gas because it'll cost, you know, every car is just going to be so expensive now because it requires that. Well, guess what? Federal regulation came in and said, no more leaded gas. And they're like, oh, okay. Here's our car. We can make it run without, and it's going to cost the same.
We were ready.
yeah. So it's good that you reflected on that. The myths that are told to support certain viewpoints tug at your heartstrings, right? You just said, like, young people can't afford homes. I'm thinking, oh, that's terrible. But it's not because of wetlands.
Right. So the other group is farmers who, as a group, have been told that wetland regulation is going to regulate their farms. Mm. And that's really not the case. The federal law and the state rule both allow for farming to continue as it always has. You can't go out and convert an existing wetland to farmland without, you know, going through proper channels. But if you have a tile break and you have a wetland that crops up, you're allowed to fix that tile. Mm. If you have some drainage that has, like your subsurface drainage has gotten clogged up or is less efficient over time, you're allowed to maintain to its prior standard. So all of this wetland regulation means really no change for farmers. Farmland that's currently being farmed can continue to be farmed. But there's a fear that farmers are not going to be allowed to farm their own land anymore. It's another misnomer that's kind of being propagated with a certain objective in mind. I think the groups that need to get on board are cities and towns and counties that are paying for infrastructure repairs or upgrades to deal with the repercussions of less landscape storage that goes with wetland loss. Because let's say you do away with wetland regulation altogether. So in theory, now home prices are going to come down 25%, although we all know the overheated market is not going to relent. But let's say, in theory, that myth is true. Now home building is going to increase and wetland destruction is going to increase. And people who bought those very affordable homes are not going to be able to afford their taxes because all of the infrastructure costs that go with these increased floods.
Yeah. Not only that, but insurance loss and so forth. Because if you lose a sponge, if you wring out all the sponges and throw them away, you don't have protections. You don't have these natural protections. Now, Scott, the couple questions, particularly about mitigation. As then the next we're going to dive very strongly into solutions. Okay, I lose a wetland in Montgomery County, but then I build one in Park County. I just made up some counties. Actually, they are real counties. Are we looking at the net percent of wetlands that are protected or formed, or does it matter where they are?
So the way the Corps does it and the EPA looks at it with the regulations, we look at it as generally a watershed approach. Everything, we're looking at it more as a macro watershed. So theoretically, that watershed may be able to made up of two or three counties, or maybe more for if you're a larger county or a larger watershed. So while it may be in a separate county, it hopefully is within that same watershed. Whatever that water, that main receiving water is at when they're leaving the watershed, that's where that is being benefited at. So you may be in Montgomery County and it may be in Park County, but they may be in the same watershed. That's where we're looking at it. We're looking at it more on a macro scale and not necessarily on a micro scale. You can do what we call permittee responsible, usually permittee responsible within the same general vicinity, or even banks and stuff, they may be. But when you start getting into some of the bigger banks, they're usually on the watershed, those bigger areas. Mm-hmm. So we kind of get away from kind of right next door, right on the same property, right across the street type thing. It may not be right in the same neighborhood that impact occurred, but it is hopefully within that same watershed so that the White River watershed is protected in that if the mitigation is downstream and the impact's upstream, theoretically, the idea is that watershed is still being positively affected to account for that impact when it leaves that watershed.
Okay. No, that's helpful to know because I was thinking, well, when you start going down to the sub-watershed scale, let's say, you know, not to belabor the science of it, but then, you know, you wonder, like, if you're trying to target a cleanup, let's say you have a water quality issues in one area, one sub watershed, then you'd want to think, well, I probably need to add some green infrastructure, you know, even if they're constructed wetlands, even if they're not as good, quote unquote, as natural wetlands, they serve some function, right?
Oh, definitely. And I mean, yeah, so you can get there. I mean, they're all going to serve a function. I was like, but from the regulated side of it, it's kind of where we focus that regulations allow that. So that way a landowner may, or an applicant may have an opportunity to acquire land or has other land in this other town that may be in the same watershed, and he can work on that property, thinking in like an ag, in the ag field, a farmer may have property in several different locations that he's farming, and he may have an area that is no longer suitable for crops. It's just wet all the time, or he can't get crops out of it. Well, if he needs mitigation for another project he wants to do, he may be able to turn that area into wetland to compensate for that loss and no longer struggle with that side. And it may not be next door, but it still may be in that watershed.
And that's good to know. I mean, so it is really a science-informed, yeah, rather than, oh, this county and that county, which can very easily be, you know, in different watersheds, for example. So,
yeah, we're really, our mitigation goals really get into the kind of like the functional assessments. Is it a functional assessment? Are you biologically, are you improving that function of that resource? Kind of like, okay, you're saying, or replacing the functions that are lost.
Great. And now I'm going to switch over as we sort of wrap things up, package things up. I've heard a lot of loss, a lot of concerns about regulatory, deregulation of a lot of these things, and not a lot of support for our poor, lonely forested wetlands or great marsh. I'm sorry. So let's talk a little bit about solutions. I think you started touching on this a little bit about when you started narrowing down on communities. Let's narrow from, okay, we're here in the beautiful Butler University campus, right, on the White River watershed in the city of Indianapolis. So we're in a watershed, to your point, Scott, but we are a city that can make its own regulations and make its own decisions about development, right? Supporting or not supporting wetlands to some extent. What, I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, in the absence of federal or state regulation, local government organizations have options. You see that in Illinois, certain counties, or even villages up around Chicago have wetland regulations. So it can fall to the local level. There are some existing avenues, NPDES Phase 2, a National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, okay, which really deals with construction stormwater quality. So it's erosion control during construction, but then also post-construction stormwater quality. Best management practices, BMPs. Mm-hmm. And phase two of that dealt with medium to smaller sized communities. So Indianapolis was a phase one community, a big, big community. And then like Lafayette, Tippecanoe County, Allen County, Fort Wayne, Bloomington, those are phase two communities. And so that there's an avenue there to generate some protections for wetlands. But beyond that, I suppose people could write new laws on the local level. I don't know how popular that would be. But there are programs that encourage volunteer restoration, preservation. Last year, there was a wetland law that didn't get nearly as much attention as the rewriting of the state wetland regulation law. And it dealt with classifying wetlands as wildland. If you have a wetland on your property, you can get either tax incentives or tax credits to protect it, conserve it, preserve it. There are other programs out there, mostly with the NRCS, National Resource Conservation Service, under the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, that, you know, promote preservation, restoration, conservation. So in Indiana, obviously, a lot of our landscape is ag land. And so that's an option. In the absence of regulation and the requirement to protect, taking it out of the landowner's ability to choose, in the absence of that, there have to be incentives. And then I think also what we talked about earlier, people have to recognize wetlands for what they are and for the value that they provide to humans. And I kind of thought that during COVID, there was so much outdoorsiness. You know, everybody became an outdoorsman. I kind of hoped then the value would become more apparent. But I think we've all gone back to just the way it was before on that front.
What pandemic?
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I think that there has to be, like I said, draw a straight line between wetlands and what they provide to everyday people.
Great. Now, Scott, what if then, so you've helped protect wetlands. That's what you do by implementing and approving projects. What's been your biggest win?
I would say the biggest win would be probably getting more mitigation banks online within the state. Prior to about 5-6 years ago, there were very few in the state. It was very desolate for mitigation banks. And in the last 5 years, there's been a explosion, a heavy interest in what's going on in the state. And so there are many more banks throughout the entire state, all the way up from up north to down south, that have developed, that are approved or in various processes of being approved.
Okay, so that's first. I love that you brought that. Could you please explain to the audience what a mitigation bank is? It's not like National Bank of Indianapolis or something like that, right?
Yeah, so essentially a mitigation bank is a private landowner, a business entity develops a large section of wetlands. It could be 30 acres, it could be 80 acres of wetlands. So they develop a plan, and they're going to build this type of wetland. And this wetland area, they're going to turn this 30 acres of non-wetland into wetland. And then through the banking process and all the approvals, they'll get a certain number of credits that therefore they can sell to the public to offset the impacts for what those impacts may be. So, for example, a developer, a home builder wants to build a home or build a residential subdivision that has to impact wetlands and they need to mitigate those impacts, then they can go to the mitigation bank if they're in that same service area that bank works at and buys credits from the bank if they're available. And by doing that, the developer doesn't have to worry about building, offsetting the mitigation, building the wetlands, getting them to meet success, and possibly if they don't restarting over, they can just buy the credits and keep moving. And while the bank is responsible for getting that mitigation in the ground.
Interesting. So that's a lot like carbon trading that goes on. And it's complex because you have to have enough deposits to offset the withdrawals, however you want to put that, because the bank has to remain fungible. But if overseen correctly, obviously it works, right?
Yeah, it's huge at this point. It's been going on in a lot of part of the country, especially Southwest, Southeast have been huge. There are hundreds of banks in those areas. In certain other states, they're quite large. So it's finally getting more of those into the state that kind of helps bring those resources back or offsets those to where it's a more functioning wetland to replace what's being lost.
Fantastic. No, thank you for bringing that up. That gets to the next point. So you've already given your thing what's the future look like? There are some positives. Rochelle, reflect, get people encouraged that the world is going to be a better place. What are some positives you see around wetlands? Is it needing to engage public engagement more, like this COVID effect you have to say? Or
I think that the bright spot I see in Indiana is that other rule that I was talking about a minute ago was sponsored by Republicans. It was passed in a bipartisan way. I think there is hope for recognition of, I think that actually the law that was passed last year with all of the hearings and the publicity that it got, I think it was an opportunity for a large scale educational program sort of that just surrounded those rules, that rulemaking. And so hopefully it hit home with some people that these are not waste areas. These are not areas that are in the way of progress. These are not things that are expendable. There are consequences and costs associated with losing them. So I think there was some understanding of that. If we can get this to stop being like a hot button issue, if you are of this party, you believe this, and if you are of that party, you believe that, and just stick with the facts and what's known, maybe we can get some protections back. And then in the absence of that, you know, it's gonna have to come down to incentives and good-willed people. There are a lot of land trusts that are in the state that are working hard to preserve land. There are a lot of good people that are donating land to those land trusts. I mean, it's gonna be a big effort. You know, if we don't do it now, we're not gonna have any choice but to fix all these problems later. And it's like erosion control. It's far cheaper to not let the soil erode than it is to get the soil back out of the water. It's far cheaper to protect our wetlands now than to do everything it takes to replace the lost functionality later.
True. Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. And a lot of these things I think, well, what will my grandkids say? Will they kick me or will they, you know, hug me?
I have a 9-year-old. I think about that a lot.
Yeah, it's important. I mean, because, we often... obviously, legislative cycles are 2 years, and the world is going to last a little bit longer than that. Scott, Rochelle, it's been a pleasure having you on The Collective Tap.
Thank you. Thanks for having us and covering this super important topic.
Thank you for having us.
We want to thank Butler University for sponsoring the podcast and hosting us here. Our thanks also to the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust for making all of this possible. You can find us online at thecollectivetap.com. That's thecollectivetap, all one word, .com. And on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram with that handle. Join us next time on The Collective Tap as we dive deeper into the world of water.